From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. What's the difference between the winners and the losers?
They got a name for the winners in the world. I want a name when I lose.
Well, the difference between winning and losing can not only be how good you are, but how competitive you are. Science writers Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman take a look at the science of winning and losing in their new book. It's called Top Dog. Thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ross. Always great to be home.
A lot of revelations in this book, including you kind of debunk, in a way, the notion that if you practice something for 10,000 hours, you're going to be an expert at it. Macklemore, our homegrown rapper, has an entire song about that, and he writes about that as a key to success. You write in your book, it's not necessarily practicing that's the key to winning.
Right. It's not just practicing. It's we're not judging how we practice. We're judging how we perform. And you can be one of those people who practices great but performs very divergently, and that you need to be able to be good at summoning your competitive energy for that moment of performance. And we wanted to know what makes someone good at that.
Well, John wrote to us on our Facebook page, we get worse when we compete. We get better when we cooperate. Our economic system is not aligned with human nature. So he thinks in our true nature, we would cooperate and not compete. And you do concede in the book, Ashley, that there is a bad form of competition and a good form of competition.
Well, that's right. And what I think we first need to understand is that in productive forms of competition, and I don't think anybody has a problem saying, you know, Michael Phelps is a very competitive guy, right? And that would be something we would want to aspire to. And we would probably, he might object, but most people, when, you know, Obama or a politician says our country needs to be more competitive, also think that that's good. But I think we have this concern, you know, to be competitive, do you have to sacrifice your integrity? Do you have to cheat? Do you have to be willing to sell someone out? And I don't think that's true. In fact, the research says that great competitors, people who are in it for the long term, respect their competition, respect their opponents, and understand I don't necessarily, you know, I'm not going to win every time, but I can improve every time. I can use these as new targets to keep going forward. And when we're talking about, you know, the difference between competition and capitalism or competition and cooperation, I think that's a false choice, because so often we're competing and collaborating, right? If you and I are playing, you know, an average board game, we're still agreeing what the rules are. We've agreed that we have the same premise. We could play on a team together. So there's a lot of collaboration even in those moments of competition.
You know, I'm glad you brought up teams and teamwork, because everybody doesn't get to play on the team. Just the first string gets to play. So there's competition within the team. How do you nourish that competition but make sure that people come together when the team needs to work together and not be competitive one to the other?
One of my favorite things we learned from this book was time spent with Anson Dorrance, the women's college soccer coach at University of North Carolina, who in December won his 22nd national title. He's probably the most successful college sports coach in any sport in history. And his tactic is he really trains his female players to be competitive in practice. He makes them, measures everything on this 23-factor matrix. They're posted on the locker room wall. The players have to work up the ladder to sort of, you know, beat each other in practice. But around games, he de-stresses them. He gives them roses in the locker room. He writes them heartfelt letters about all of the great talents that they have, that they're read aloud in locker rooms. He never yells at them or even raises his voice whatsoever around a game. In fact, his favorite halftime speech he ever gave is they were down at halftime and just walked into the room and he said, "Well, what do you think?" And the girls started taking responsibility and culping to what they had missed and what they could do better, and they went out and played great. So a lot of this is getting people up for competition, but also making sure it doesn't get too stressful on them, that they perform well in the moment.
How do you get someone to be the right level of stress? You don't want to be too relaxed, but you don't want to be freeze because you're too stressed out.
Well, there isn't a right of level of stress for everyone. Each of us has our own level, and where we think this is the level of excitement that I need to do best. You know, researchers found that Bob Hope would tell all of his writers that if he wasn't nervous, before going on stage, it was going to be a bad show. So for him, he actually thought a real heightened level of anxiety and stress was going to be beneficial to him. Other people might say, well, I want a little bit of excitement, because if there's nothing, then I'm not even, you know, prepared for the fact that I'm going to be performing. I'm going to compete. But it's a wide range. You're an elite athlete, you know, on a scale looking at anxiety from, you know, they range from 20 to 67 and the high is 80. So it really depends. But what's interesting is that experts tend to find that anxiety is beneficial performance. They're like Bob Hope. They're thinking, I'm engaged, I'm ready, I'm going to go for it. Amateurs tend to think anxiety is actually a bad sign. They're rattled, they're scared, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to do badly now. And their nervousness just makes it worse.
Is there any way to assess your own right level of stress to bring out the best of your competitive self versus freaking out, or you just have to go out and try it and see what works?
Well, I think it's both, actually. You do need to, I mean, when the researchers are trying to figure out from athletes what your best performance is, what's your worst, and they want you to recall what those emotional states you're in are. But, you know, what we understand is beneficial isn't necessarily right. Well, we write about Jeremy Jameson, a researcher who was looking at Harvard undergrads who were studying for the graduate record exam. You know, they're trying to get into grad school. Enormously stressful experience. And right before a practice test, half of the students taking that test were told, recent research says that anxiety may actually improve your performance. So if you're thinking that you're going to be, if you're stressed, don't think you're doing badly, you might be doing better. And this wasn't then calming them down. Whew, I can be calm because, you know, mm-hmm. It's okay. They were actually more biologically keyed up.
And how did they do?
50 points higher on the math section than the others. And in the actual, and that was the practice test, but the actual exam, which happened months later, and there was no follow-up. Jeremy didn't call them and say, hey, remember, anxiety is good for you along the way. 3-6 months later, they came back with their real scores and they'd done 65 points higher.
Wow.
So it was that interpreting anxiety means I'm keyed up, I'm excited, I'm focused, actually helped them.
I'm speaking with Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson. They've written a book about the idea of competition. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. I mean, there's competition. If you and I play tennis, it's fairly direct. But there's also competition of like hundreds of people who are taking SAT tests. And you write that the different levels of competition really bring out different things in people. If you're competing with a lot of people, it can be harder to make yourself competitive.
Right. You need to feel like you have a fighting chance. Anybody in any environment, from kid to adult, their performance will be affected by whether they feel they have a fighting chance, whether if they can dial the effort level up to 10 or 11, that's actually going to matter. And one of the most interesting manifestations of this is in SAT scores. Scholars have found that taking an SAT in a crowded room, like a big gym with hundreds of other test takers there, means lower scores. Every kid knows that on November 7th, that Saturday, half the country of high school seniors is taking the SAT that day, but to face it in person and to stumble on a question and raise your head in the middle of the test and look around the room and see everybody else you're competing to go to college with is lowering kids' scores. Taking them in a smaller room will increase the scores.
We're at 206-543-5869. Everybody has competed at one time or another. What have you learned about competing well? It's 800-289-5869. Maybe you've just got a question about the science of winning and losing. For Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, you can write to us, conversation@kuow.org. So Tori wrote to us, her idea of competition is, I compete with myself. Is that a competition that hones your skills and makes you get better, Ashley?
Well, you know, I think it's actually an imaginatory competition because you only really know how you're competing against yourself once you've seen what the other guy can do, right? I mean, I can be really proud of the fact that I'm working out in my video in my apartment going, yeah, I've done so many exercises. It's not until I get into the gym and I see what everybody else is doing that I'm like, oh, I'm really not actually working all that hard, am I? So I think at least at reference points, having those competitions with other people help us move further. It doesn't mean I have to take out my opponents, right? And I think that's where people sort of get caught up in the, oh, I'm just competing against myself. Don't have to be destructive, but those people are still relevant to me. They're still showing me how to not take what I think is the most I can do for granted. You know, we write in the book about Jason Lezak at the Beijing Olympics and how he did this phenomenal burst of activity and had swum faster than anybody ever to win the relay. But we all have to remember that almost every other person in the pool swimming with him was also beating world record time. Hmm. They were so motivated by everyone else doing their absolute best. That helped them find their own best.
Alec Baldwin gave one of the great speeches trying to motivate competition among salesmen in Glengarry, Glen Ross.
Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
So are threats an effective way to get people to be more competitive in a good fashion?
Some people can handle high stress levels. They're biologically prone to be able to do that. But by and large, when you tip someone from what's called a challenge state into a threat state, physiologically different things triggered. Your veins go from vasodilation to vasoconstriction. But specifically, you know, we tell the story of that very scene from Glengarry Glen Ross in the book, and we describe it as an example of prize spreads. First place, Cadillac Eldorado. Third place, you're fired. The inevitable result, as David Mamet constructed, was an office break-in and theft of the Glengarry sales leads, right? And we use that fictional story as a parallel to NASCAR Daytona 500 1979, a day when on the final lap, the Allison brothers and Cale Yarborough had long had a rivalry. And the economists looked back and they looked at what first place was being the prize for first place and second place and third place. And they said that the spreads were so wide that it would inevitably lead to a lot of crashes, risky driving, too high of speeds, and poor sportsmanship amongst drivers. And on that particular race, as we retold the story, in the final lap, Donnie Allison and Cale Yarborough crashed into each other. Richard Petty won the race, and then the cameras panned back to the two crash cars, and the drivers were out of their cars bashing each other with the helmets. Certainly, when you, just like the office break-in, when you overly incentivize and create those threats, you can get very poor sportsmanship, bad competitive energy. It's something that you'll generate whenever you create a winner-takes-all type of scenario.
Hope Bronson and Ashley Merriman with me, 206-543-5869. Jump in wherever you would like to if you'd like to weigh in on this. How much of our competitive spirit are we born with?
Well, I think there are definitely genetic factors, hormonal factors that change how we perform in competition. You know, there's a hormone called the there's a gene called the COMP gene, which changes how you process dopamine, a neurotransmitter in the prefrontal cortex of your brain. And one version, which the scientists have nicknamed the warrior gene, has your sort of, I call it recycling. It's how much dopamine is sort of transmitted and then reabsorbed into the brain. And the warrior version is four times slower than this other version called the warrior gene. And the warriors on an average day have higher working memory. They're able to plan and organize and really get sort of excited and focused about minutiae. And they do really well until experiences of stress. And in stress, stress also brings dopamine because your brain is trying to motivate yourself to get through the stressful experience. But for the warriors, it's too much dopamine and their brains just melt down, sort of like flooding a car engine with gas. All of a sudden, just shorts out. Whereas the warriors actually don't have enough dopamine on the average day. They're just not as excited and engaged in the material. So they end up needing stress to do their best.
So does a genetic test tell us whether we're a warrior or a warrior? Is it something, I mean, are we pre-inclined to one or the other?
Well, I mean, the genes are really common. 50% of us have both. 25% have just the warrior gene, and 25% of us have just the warrior gene. But I think the important thing to do is, you know, we don't need to walk around and cheek swab everybody. It's to look and say,
thank goodness.
Yeah. I don't need, you know, I even vacillate, you know, I'm a warrior or a warrior. Well, I worry that I'm a warrior. So that's, you know,
but I'm fighting my warrior.
Exactly. But I think that's the key is then to say, okay, I'm realizing I'm more susceptible to stressful experiences. So can I train myself to prepare for those things so that I'm not so caught off guard. If I'm a warrior, how do I make myself more focused and excited when it may be lacking? So it's not about pigeonholing yourself. It's about right. using this information to be better no matter where you are.
So knowing our genetic inclination can help us to form our behavior in a different way. Right. Poe, are men more competitive than women?
That's a myth. Right. So once men and women are in a competition, they're equally driven towards succeeding in that competition. They do, though, and we came to the science very reluctantly, have somewhat different competitive styles. Simply in choosing whether or not to compete, scholars used to bring men and women into labs and they'd give them some game to play and they would see how hard they played or how much they tried. And, you know, a lot of women might have been just saying, you know, this is just some stupid game. What do I care? When it comes to something that matters to me, I'm in. And the proxy for this, or that's a proxy for what we see in politics and women entering political campaigns. Certainly women, when they're on the ballot, have been winning, but only four U.S. women ran for governor in 2012, filled out any sort of ballot materials of any kind. But the real science underlying this is not that women are afraid to compete. It's that women are very sensitive to the odds of winning. When the odds of winning in a political contest are below 20%, most of the contestants will be men. But when the odds improve, they go from 20% to 1/3, 40%, women start jumping in droves and, in fact, will be more competitive than men. So what the science is showing is a pattern, which is that men, on average, tend to be good at ignoring the odds, which sometimes can be helpful. Women are very good at assessing the risk and assessing the odds and highly responsive to those odds.
One of the criticisms of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, your book, is that the competitive fire isn't a scientific concept. You talk about the science of winning and losing. According to this critique, it's difficult to analyze in a comprehensive way. It changes from person to person so quickly, it's hard to come up with an objective analysis of it. How do you respond to that critique, Ashley?
Well, I think that that particular review was misleading in saying that what we're really talking about is motivation and participation. And there's no shortage of scientists who are looking at how we assess motivation and what are the factors that are going in it. And that's what we're looking for, is the stuff that's... And the reason we talk about it in terms of competitive fire is because competition is a particular sort of heightened state of engagement that you don't necessarily have. I may be motivated to get to work on time, but that's not exactly the same as what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is in a contest, in a high pressure demand for perform, how we're going to move forward. And there's no shortage of studies on that.
Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having us.
The new book, The Science of Winning and Losing, is called Top Dog. David Hyde produces our show with Arwen Nix. We get production help from Amber Cortez. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds.